ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
It's Monday, which means it's time for another installment of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Helping us make sense of the latest political developments is Maverick Citizen Managing Editor Sekiswa Pikoli. Here's what's coming your way. Out with the old and in with the, new? Dada Morero takes over as Joburg mayor. Then, the latest unemployment figures highlight the desperate situation so many South Africans find themselves in. Later, a new human trafficking report places South Africa at the center of criminal networks operating across the continent.
What's worrying is also the collusions from officials that often assist this trafficking, and I think that's a massive gap that we need to be looking at.
And does a sperm donor a father make? A recent ruling says no. But first, Floyd Shivambu, one of the founding members of the Economic Freedom Fighters, defected in dramatic fashion last week, leaving the political party facing an uncertain future. What the exact reasons for his departure might be are unclear, but one thing is certain, more EFF comrades are sure to follow suit. Welcome back to the show, Sekiswa. It's always lovely having you with us. How have you been?
Hi, Lizanne. I've been okay. How have you been?
I've been good. Let's kick things off with the biggest story of the week, and that is, of course, the EFF's leadership crisis. This after co-founder of the Red Berets, Floyd Shivambu, confirmed that he'll be joining Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto we Sizwe party, or the MK party. Julius Malema said during Thursday's press conference that he was blindsided by Shivambu's resignation. I think a number of South Africans were too. Firstly, what's your take on this very dramatic development?
Yeah, dramatic would be the word. I think everybody, as soon as they heard, kind of took a collective breath in. Like, what?
Yes.
Yes, we have known that there have been some tensions between Julius and Floyd, but I don't think we would have expected that it culminates in the fashion that it did. And I think probably the most surprising thing was that he decided to defect to Zuma's MK party, which I think a lot of people are wondering about, and what would have drawn him there.
Yes, definitely. Now, Shivambu's exit, of course, brings with it a massive political shift, with insiders saying more EFF members are set to follow Shivambu to his new political home, which is the MK party. It's not yet clear who will be packing their EFF bags, but some names have been repeatedly thrown around in recent days, and that includes the head of political education, Buyiseni Ndlozi. Then we have the national chair, Veronica Mente, the deputy SG, Poppy Mailola, and Dali Mpofu, who's been representing the MK party in court recently. So I think that one might not surprise too many people. Do you see the EFF in its current form really surviving this imminent exodus? Because many people have said that this is the end of the EFF, purely because it's a party that's been run mostly on personality more than policy, really.
I would hesitate to say that this is the end for the EFF. I don't think Malema would let it go without a fight. But I think probably what presents is exactly what you are pointing out, which is this sort of politics of personality. I mean, I really think it's going to be a test in terms of what are the leadership structures that they have in place and succession planning that they would have had as a political party worth its weight in salt. So I think it's going to be a test. I think Floyd was obviously a key figure. I think he's also one of those kind of charismatic, larger-than-life figures. But what remains to be seen is it possible for Malema and his current cohort of leadership to reassess and lean into the succession planning to make sure that this is not the end of the political party?
Because as we know, you know, Shivambu was really instrumental, especially in mobilizing the party's student movements back in the day, and also with formulating political strategy and policy over the last decade. So losing his insights and experience is definitely a huge blow to the party. But you touched on the rumor that there was a fallout between Shivambu and Malema, and some are saying that this is actually kind of more Malema's doing in a way, because he got wind of Shivambu's alleged plan to oust him during the December elective conference. But there's also the other rumor, which is a bit more of a conspiracy theory in a way, that this is all just part of a much bigger political strategy by the so-called Progressive Caucus. This includes, of course, the EFF, MK Party, ATM, UAT, and the NCC. Basically, this is part of a bigger plan to topple the GNU in the upcoming elections.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say, right? We can speculate as much as we want. But I do think there's something to whatever the tensions were that we had all been kind of picking up on. I think probably Shivambu may have had ambitions that may have been not necessarily aligned with what Malema was probably thinking from his perspective. Again, I speak about this issue of succession planning of, is Julius meant to just be the leader for life? And was Floyd happy to just be the deputy leader for life? And if there wasn't space for that, where would he then go? So I think obviously somebody made him an offer within Zuma's MK party that seemed a lot more lucrative. And maybe from his perspective meant that he can grow his political career, I guess, in more alignment to what he saw himself as a future that kind of grows him beyond one position.
It's time to pause and reset. This was the message from Joburg's newly appointed mayor, Dada Morero. Having secured 189 votes during a council meeting held last week Friday, Morero certainly has his work cut out for him. With a city teetering on the edge of collapse, residents are hoping he will be the man to pull them back from the abyss. But some experts and civic leaders are not so sure, saying it will just be more of the same.
Let's move on to another political shift that happened last week, and we're moving to Johannesburg after Aljamar's Kabelo Gwamanda resigned as city mayor, which I don't think came as a surprise to any of us, because there's been growing pressure from civic society and also from political parties just to get him out of that seat. But Joburg now has a new mayor in the form of Dada Morero from the ANC. You're a Joburger. How do you feel about the new mayor? Do you think it's all in the mayor's hands, or what do you think needs to happen? Because let's be honest, Joburg is in a terrible state.
Yes, I mean, I can't vouch for the mayor just yet. I don't actually know what his chops are in terms of being a mayor. I know he was one in 2022 for 25 days.
Yes, so, a whole 25 days, yes.
A full 25 days. I mean, we've had a succession of musical chairs of mayors over the last few years. And so it remains to be seen what Dada really is going to do that would be different to what Kabelo Gwamanda had done. Because, yes, also, we must remember that he was meant to be a caretaker mayor. He was never meant to be a permanent placement. So it remains to be seen if that is going to be doing anything that is going to be significant in terms of what Joburg is facing. You know, our infrastructure issues are so problematic. And I think this current consistent change in leadership and lack of continuity in planning and implementation of the things that need to be put into place in order for Joburg to get back to being the vital city that it needs to be remains the real core issue that we should be focusing on, and not necessarily from which political party that mayor is coming from. What we need is for that person to actually do what his obligations set out for him.
And we also need to ensure that, because, you know, it's one thing having a competent person right at the top, but without competent city leaders, CEOs, municipal managers, very little will really improve on ground level. So for me, that is kind of where the focus needs to shift within Joburg at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, Joburg has a number of issues, right? And when I talk about infrastructure, we have buildings that are within the city that are disused and in a state that are actually quite hazardous as they stand. And what is the city doing around that? And to link to that is this issue of housing, the housing crisis that we're facing, right? Mm-hmm. We have disused buildings that could actually be used towards helping within that housing crisis, which was highlighted, obviously, with the Marshalltown fire, you know?
Yes.
So that's one of the key things that Joburg needs to really look at, the issue of human settlement, what is happening with people. The other thing is you've got now roads that are collapsing and potholes and things like that and blowing up. So what is actually going on there? So I think there's a lot of issues that I think from a structural perspective, we need to kind of put into focus. And I'm really hoping that this current crop of leadership is going to be able to attend to those things, because how else are you going to run a city so that it is a world-class city, but it's a city that actually serves the people that live within it?
On Tuesday, Stats SA released its latest unemployment figures, and it made for some depressing reading. At 33.5%, South Africa's unemployment rate is the highest it's been since 2022. And it shows that 4.8% more South Africans feel there's little to no prospect of them finding work within the next year. Most sectors have seen a marked drop in job opportunities, but the job crisis for domestic workers is showing no signs of abating. Pre-COVID, about 1 million domestic workers were employed across South Africa. At the height of the pandemic, around 250,000 of those workers lost their jobs. And by the end of 2023, only around 125,000 of those jobs had been recovered.
Now, let's move on to the latest unemployment figures. They were released last week, and it's risen to a two-year high, coming in at 33.5%. Now, according to Stats SA, this means approximately 8.4 million people are now without a job. And of these, around 76% have been unemployed for more than a year. Just to put this into perspective for our listeners, this means that 111,000 jobs were lost in the trade sector, while agriculture saw about 45,000 jobs lost in the last quarter. It's really depressing figures. We've asked this many times on the show, but really, how do you fix this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think how you fix it is to have a plan in terms of how do we address our unemployment, but also looking at what is driving it, right? So we already have a situation where a large part of our jobs downturn was driven by COVID, and we haven't recovered from that, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that, you know, the measures that have been put in place by government have sufficiently addressed that. I think also one of the things that we need to consider is this issue of having a basic income grant. Because, you know, a basic income grant isn't just about giving somebody money to just survive off every month. It actually helps with people in terms of being able to better themselves educationally, skill themselves. And if you're not able to do that, then it becomes difficult for people to be able to go and meaningfully participate in the jobs market. So I think there's a lot that needs to be implemented here. But also, for example, some of these short-term kind of jobs that come up, specifically look at what's been happening in the city of Joburg now, Gauteng, with this Nasisbani initiative that's been initiated by the premier. And you have to look at the longevity of that, right? And what is that actually meant to drive? And what is the dent that actually makes? And, you know, how many people actually benefit from that? So I think there's a lot in terms of planning and looking at how you attack the jobs issue.
Globally, about 27 million people are trafficked in various ways, from working on farms and in mines, or serving unsuspecting patrons in restaurants, to being forced into sex work. The trafficking of human beings has become a lucrative criminal enterprise. In Africa, most traffickers are allowed to act with impunity, as officials and traffickers often work hand in hand to facilitate the illegal movement of persons across borders. With at least 7 million people in Africa having fallen victim to trafficking, a new report out of the US has found that South Africa is increasingly becoming the preferred country for the trade in persons.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Department of State released its 2024 Trafficking in Persons report, and it highlighted how South Africa has sort of become this stopover of sorts for human traffickers. It details which provinces have seen an increase in reported trafficking incidents, and then it also shows how trafficking syndicates operate in South Africa and neighboring countries. It was really an eye-opener.
Yeah, I mean, it can only be frightening, right? Because we never want to be a haven for trafficking. I don't think that's something that we want to be known for. And I think that speaks to our law enforcement, but also our crime prevention tactics, right? I think for me, you need to have a system that is more responsive, more than it is reactive, because by the time that you discover somebody has been trafficked or there's been trafficking that's been happening, it's too late. So you need to be able to pick those things up. And that takes the capacitation of the institution that will be able to do that. But also what's worrying is also the collusions from officials that often assist this trafficking. And I think that's a massive gap that we need to be looking at. And how do we stop that? How do we stop people being susceptible to being used in that sense?
One aspect that stood out for me, and this is because we did a story on this not too long ago, is the custom of ukutwala, or forced marriage, especially seen in the Eastern Cape and KZN. And this report mentioned this specifically, saying that it often enables human traffickers from exploiting young girls. Then there was also another interesting aspect for me that I never thought of, is also the concept of so-called bucky brokers, as they call them. It's basically brokers used by farmers to find foreign migrants to assist during harvest season. And it's completely unregulated, and it really serves as the perfect opportunity for traffickers to take advantage of mostly unsuspecting foreign nationals. So there's so much that needs to be addressed, and there are so many aspects to this, because I think a lot of the times people hear human trafficking and they think sex workers mostly, people being forced into sex work, or it's drug mules. Usually that's what they kind of think of. But it's also labor. It's the labor force. A huge chunk of the labor force in South Africa consists a lot of the times of people forced into that industry, and there's no way of them getting out of it.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's also one of the things that's often overlooked, that trafficking probably may not look like the face that you are expecting to see. It's not going to be somebody in a balaclava somewhere. It may actually just be your neighbor you don't know. And I think it's important that we kind of blow the lid on that and actually show the many faces of it, so that people are able to actually know the kinds of signs to be looking out for and what kind of practices can be considered or identified as suspicious practices, so that you can actually blow the whistle on that. Just in terms of trafficking, for me, the story of Jocelyn Smith in Cape Town comes up as well. And we still don't know what happened in that instance, you know. So it's so prevalent, but it's one of those things that I think we need to be alive to as South Africans.
Here's the story. A man agrees to become a sperm donor to help his female friend fall pregnant. Following artificial insemination, the woman falls pregnant with twins. 3 months later, the sperm donor dies. Now, is that woman entitled to a death benefit? A recent ruling has once again said absolutely not.
I saw a wonderful piece from your colleague Nisa Moodley last week on a ruling that I found quite fascinating. I don't think it's something we think about too often. In short, a woman tried to get the pension fund adjudicator to recognize her twin children as the rightful beneficiaries to her sperm donor's retirement annuity fund. The pension fund adjudicator said no, because the Children's Act currently states that any sperm donor does not fall under the definition of a parent and therefore cannot be held accountable in terms of maintenance and so forth, or just the basic parenting rights that they would have. So this was such an interesting case for me, because with the increase in IVF across the world, I think it's such an important case that is maybe up for debate perhaps. So what is your take on this story? I found it fascinating.
Yeah, I also found it fascinating. I was like, what? But I do understand why the law would also have to kind of be quite strict when it comes to something like this, because if you leave it open-ended that anyone can claim that a sperm donor is going to be now a parent and has obligations, in this instance, rights to somebody's pension fund, it becomes difficult, because when you're a sperm donor, it doesn't necessarily mean you're only donating to one person. You know, there's like a myriad of people that are going to be beneficiaries of your sperm. And so what happens now when all of these people decide to come and claim? I think that's worth regulating. But I think probably also what this highlights is that as people enter into these kinds of contracts or different ways of conceiving and having children, you think about the future and what this may necessarily actually mean. So I think probably what she had neglected to do at the time was to get into a formal contractual agreement with them in terms of this co-parenting that they've now decided to, as opposed to an ad hoc kind of agreement, which is not going to be enforceable according to the law.
Yeah, and the adjudicator definitely agreed on that point as well, saying, listen, there was no formal agreement. Had this donor had any intention to be a full-on parent, he should have stated that. You should have drawn up a contract saying that he will be the legal father of these kids, but that never happened. And so, unfortunately, you're not entitled to anything.
What was interesting, though, for me was also just like this, the different classifications, right? That if it's artificially, even if you are with your partner, but for as long as it's artificially inseminated, it's not the same as biological, which becomes automatic that you become a parent. So I think that's also worth highlighting, that how you actually conceive of your child is important to keep in mind.
Yes. And there was something, if I'm not mistaken, about also if you have a sperm donor, even though you agree verbally that this sperm donor will be the father to your children and be involved in their lives, if you're not married, again, that complicates what you can lay claim to. So it's very complex. It's very layered. And I think it definitely makes some people question, what is parenthood? Yeah. What does being a father mean? What does being a mother mean? So yeah, it's definitely a very interesting conversation.
On the 1st of July, violent protests erupted throughout Bangladesh as tens of thousands of students took to the streets. They were taking a stand against a decades-old quota employment system that prevented millions of job seekers from accessing well-paying government jobs. The students demanded change, saying jobs should be given on merit and nothing more. This after nearly 56% of all government jobs were reserved for so-called freedom fighters, ethnic minorities, persons with disabilities, and individuals from underrepresented districts. Now, nearly a week after overthrowing an autocratic government, Gen Z college students are hoping to lead the way.
Let's wrap things up with a quick reflection on the recent changes in government in Bangladesh. I think that it is quite relevant to South Africa and world leaders as a whole, because it sort of serves as a reminder that the youth have so much power when it comes to leadership in a country. I mean, in South Africa alone, we've seen the youth uprising in 1976, and we also had the almost year-long Fees Must Fall movement in 2015 and 2016, which admittedly didn't have such a big impact, but still, it changed quite a lot, and it made life much easier for many, many students. So yeah, I just thought this is a great way to kind of just wrap the show up and say, remember, the youth, while they might be sitting on TikTok and you're accusing them of just being on their phones all the time, they're still capable of doing a hell of a lot if they really want to.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, throughout history, right, the youth have always kind of been seen as being in the forefront of change and being more militant than the older people within our population. And I think a lot of movements, as you've highlighted, have been at the forefront of kind of changing moments and watershed moments and forcing things to happen where others may have seemed to have been reticent. I think one of the things that this also highlights is this issue of government policies that are put into place and are not regularly reviewed in order for you to check if this is still the right policy, if this is still relevant to where people are and how it's impacting on the population. Because one of the things is that what happens here is that systemically these kinds of things get entrenched, and what happens is that you breed a resentment within your own population or people, and then what ends up is a revolt. And most of the time it's justifiably so, because in an instance where you're reserving a large percentage of positions for specific people while there are other people who may be more qualified, who may be more suited for those positions, of course there's going to be an uprising against that. Mm-hmm. And I think in this instance, the youth actually are more kind of like a reminder that these things need to be challenged, reinvigorated, we need to think better about the systems, particularly from a governmental level.
Yeah, so definitely government, don't get too comfortable, because as we've seen this past week, things in politics can literally change overnight and then you find yourself in a completely different world. Now, it's been a really jam-packed episode today. We covered a lot of ground. I felt like we raced through a lot of it. But as always, this has been such a wonderful chat, and thank you as always for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it as well.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.